Thanks for the introduction, and I'm very happy to be here. Today I'm going to tell you about some work that I've done with two other postdocs, Marco Caldarelli, who's in Southampton, and Joan Combs, who's in Cambridge, and Costas Canderis. So I'll just start off with some motivations. I'll go very briefly just to remind you that when we want to build holography in ADS, then we can consistently embed that in string theory. And then you typically take two limits, large n, large lambda, which gives you classical gravity. And also then, instead of having a full spectrum of string theory, you're just left with Einstein gravity and the order one number of matter fields in the bulk. And then you build a correspondence, and you just say that fields in ADS are dual to local operators in the boundary CFT. And this typically means that you will build some expansion of the fields in the bulk, and then you will identify the non-normalizable mode to be the source in the field theory, and the normalizable mode to be the valve. Okay. Now, all of this construction, so it's been embedded precisely into string theory, but the arguments for holography were around before that, and they didn't rely specifically on anything that was explicitly asymptotically ADS. So typically people were talking about the way that the black hole entropy was scaling with the area of the event horizon, not with its volume. All that has nothing to do with whatever the space-time is asymptotic to. It just has to do with having a black hole. Same thing, there were ideas going on about the geometrization of the RG flow, that maybe you could treat the energy scale as some extra coordinate. So again, the ADS safety correspondence is a precise way of embedding that, but again, there's no explicit reference to ADS. And ADS CFT is just, it's not that simple, but at least symmetry-wise, it's the simplest case, because the coupling doesn't run, the beta function is zero, everything is scale invariant, so it's a pretty nice case to work with. But you might still ask yourself, so can I do something with different scaling symmetries, and so conversely with spacetime which are not asymptotically ADS? And there's been a few cases that have been worked out. So in particular, there's been these non-conformal brains, which turn out to be related to ADS by some reduction. I'll go into that in more detail next. And you can turn on some KK vectors on this reduction and have some gauge field downstairs, etc. So it's a set of theories. There's also been some work on non-relativistic holography, in particular with asymptotically Schrödinger spacetimes, because these are thought to be interesting for instance, cold atom systems, etc. And more recently, people have started to try to embed holography into this Hojava gravity. So, things have moved in different directions. But one thing which is still very puzzling is what could happen in asymptotically flat spacetime. Because way before people got an interest in ADS, gravity was mainly concerned with flat spacetimes. And the Schwarzschild black hole, the argument for the entropy, the Schwarzschild black hole still carries. It was the original argument. So it would be nice to try to say something about flat space holography. There's been a few works about that. In particular, some holographic counterterms have been proposed. And as you probably know, it's important to have these holographic counterterms because it is what allows you to make the Euclidean action finite and compute the correlation functions, etc. So it's an important part of the dictionary. But the main issue is that the defining feature of ADS holography, which is this Pfeffermann-Gram expansion, so the Pfeffermann-Gram expansion, to remind you, takes this form. It tells you that near the boundary of ADS, so ADS here is parameterized by these rho coordinates, and the boundary of ADS is at rho equals zero. So the Pfeffermann-Gram theorem tells you that in a sufficiently small neighborhood around rho equals zero, you can always put the metric in this form. So basically, you can adopt normal coordinates to the boundary. And moreover, you can expand this part of the metric, which contains all the field theory directions, both space and time. You can expand it into this power expansion. And all these coefficients here solely depend on the field theory coordinates. Yes?
In the case of the non-conformal brains, do you have a similar expansion?
I get to that. Give me a few minutes, and then. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, we'll get to that.
Yeah. Then you can ask me again if you feel like left something out. Okay, so we have this expansion, and so the nice thing is that all these coefficients are fixed by algebraic equations. That is, once you fix this G naught, which is the source for the metric, then all the rest is fixed until this term, which is not fixed, which is some extra input that you have to give, and which corresponds to the holographic stress tensor. And of course, there's the logarithmic term that appears when D is even for the Weyl anomaly. But I won't have much to say about the Weyl anomaly. Right, the different thing that happens with asymptotically flat spacetimes is that instead of having algebraic equations between all the subsequent GI, what you get is differential equations. So the theory becomes non-local. You have to know the full spacetime in order to reconstruct the next coefficient. And so that has been the main obstacle to building up the equivalent of the ADS holographic dictionary into flat spacetimes. People have tried to think about different things to do. Like, for instance, there's been a few works on defining the field theory on the light cone boundary, but then you run into other kinds of trouble because now you need to reconstruct time as well on top of the radial coordinate. So there are things that you can do, but it's complicated. And also, contrarily to the ADS-CFT case, where you know what the field theory is, when equals force per yaw mills, for instance, here you have absolutely no idea what is the microscopic theory. So I think it's fair to say that flat space holography is quite a puzzle still. So in this talk, I'll try to take a small step towards understanding that. And mainly I will prove the following statement, which has to do with the gravity part of the correspondence. The statement is that if you take a specific class of asymptotically locally ADS spacetimes, and in particular, so what they need to have is a planar transverse subspace. I'll get into details later to clarify this statement. Then there is a way to map these spacetimes to Ricci flat spacetimes. So Ricci flat for me means that they are a solution of Einstein's equation without a cosmological constant. So to be very explicit, the solution of RAB equals zero. That's what I would call Ricci flat. And in particular, it doesn't mean that they're asymptotically Minkowski, right? These are two different statements. So these asymptotically locally ADS spacetimes can be mapped to Ricci flat spacetimes that have a transverse round sphere. Now, then I'll go on and take advantage of that statement to try to make a small step toward understanding holography in this class of Ricci flat spacetimes. So I won't be able to make any fully general statement about flat space holography. And then I'll take a hydrodynamic limit, because we know how to do hydrodynamics in ADS, we know how to do hydrodynamics in flat space. And I'll show you how you can derive some information about, like, for instance, the hydro stress tensor for Ricci flat P brains and the dispersion relation of the Gregor-Laflamme instability. So in flat space, using information from ADS. And so what I will not do is set up a holographic dictionary for asymptotically flat spacetimes. You can talk about that, but I'm not going to do that here. Okay, so let's try to prove this statement that I gave you. And in order to do that, it's good to start from these non-conformal brains that you were mentioning. So the non-conformal brains are a solution to a very simple theory. You just have Einstein gravity, a neutral scalar, and some exponential potential. And then if you work out the spherically symmetric planar black holes that are the classical solutions to this action, you're led to the following solution, which takes a form which is pretty similar to asymptotically ADS planar black holes, the main difference being that there's an extra conformal factor here in front of the part of the metric which is conformal to ADS. So P is the number of spatial dimensions here. And it's parameterized, so this conformal factor is parameterized by this parameter theta. And this parameter theta also parameterizes the running of the scalar field. So, right, just a comment for those of you who are interested in ADS-CMT, those are usually best known as hyperscaling violating metrics in the ADS-CMT context. And this theta is the hyperscaling violating exponent. Just thought I'd mention that in passing. Now, if you work out what the thermodynamics are for this family of black hole solutions, then you find that there are two very distinct behaviors depending on the sign of this theta parameter. In particular, for theta negative, then you find that the thermodynamics are completely identical to those of planar ADS black holes. That is, you find that there's a single branch of stable black hole solution, which are so they are both globally and locally stable. On the other hand, if you take theta positive, then you find that you find a behavior which is similar to asymptotically flat Schwarzschild black hole. There's again a single branch of black holes which is unstable globally and locally. Yeah.
So I'm just looking. So theta is a function of delta and p. Is that
right? Exactly.
It's determined by delta.
Yeah, exactly. Theta is fixed by the action parameters. So it's dimension dependent, but mainly it's fixed by this exponent here.
What by V0?
V0 actually fixes the equivalent of the ADS radius for that spacetime. It doesn't enter, so the definition for... Right. Sorry,
I'm trying to count parameters. If it's theta versus V0 or...
Theta is fixed with respect to delta using identifying these two exponents. Sorry, I should have maybe written that explicitly. Whereas V0 fixes what this L is, and this L appears here. So it's the length scale in your family of solution. Okay, so... So you find these two things, and you think that if it looks similar, maybe there's a way that you can identify this class of solutions to these two classes of solutions. The way you do that is using some very simple Kaluza-Klein reductions. So first, let's start from some ADS theory in V plus one dimension. And then you just do the simplest Kaluza-Klein reduction you can think of. You reduce over a compact space, where turning off all Kaluza-Klein vectors and turning off all massive modes. And this is a consistent thing to do here. And so this guy you can think of it as being arbitrary, but once you plug that into Einstein's equations, you find out that it has to be an Einstein space. So it could be a sphere, but it could be any positively curved Einstein space. It could also be a negatively curved Einstein space or a flat Einstein space. So when you plug that ansatz into the field equations, you reduce the field equations, you work out what action they come from. This is the action that you find. It's very similar to the action that I had on the previous slide. The only difference is that now I have two potential terms, one coming from the higher dimensional cosmic constant, and the other one comes from the curvature of the Einstein space. And they come from with different exponents, which is an important piece of information. If you look at the field equations, they're not terribly complicated. It's just Einstein's equation with a stress tensor that comes from the neutral scalar and a Klein-Gordon equation with these two sources.
This characterizes the volume of
the... It's the Ricci curvature of that guy.
Okay.
The Ricci curvature. And you can notice one thing by looking at these field equations is that if you switch, if you exchange this minus 2 lambda for this x, and if you send delta to 2p over delta, then that leaves the field equations invariant, both the Einstein equation and the scalar equation. And you can also see, because it's a consistent truncation, it's also true at the level of the action, of course. Now, this is the statement that I will take advantage of to prove my original gravity statement. I should also mention that this has been used previously for a very specific class of metric for Weyl metrics, and that was used as solution generating techniques. Right. So to take advantage of this duality, then the statement you will make is that if you start from an ADS theory and you take any classical solution of that theory, which have these symmetries, so it should have a transverse space which is planar. It could be a torus, but it could be any Einstein space compact, which has zero Ricci curvature. Then, because of this previous duality that I had on the previous slide, you can map all these solutions to solutions of an action without a cosmological constant, where you will have a transverse Einstein space, which doesn't have zero Ricci curvature. Okay? So this is the exact statement that I want to make. I can map any solution that is a solution of Einstein's equation with a cosmological constant, which takes this form, to a solution of Einstein's equation without a cosmological constant, which takes that form. Good. So now let's take some specific examples. And since, well, maybe, so I should say that, so once I use these two ansatz into these two actions, I will go down to the same kind of theory. I will go down to a theory with Einstein gravity, a single neutral scalar, and a single exponential potential. And I know the black hole solution. I know it's a black hole solution, which is perfectly symmetric and planar, for that kind of theory, which are these non-conformal brains that I told you about. So let's look at what happens if I start from these non-conformal brains and try to lift them using both lifts. And two things which are not that surprising happen. There's two ranges of parameters, theta positive, theta negative. So this is theta negative, and if you do the lift, so I spare you the numbers, you can look at them if you want, but what you get is the AGS planar black hole in D plus one dimensions. So I should maybe tell you, I will write it up on the board. So I will have two theories. One of them is ADS, and it lives in D plus one dimensions. And the other one is Ricci flat, and it lives in N plus P plus three dimensions. And this will have a transverse R and D minus P minus one, and this will have a transverse sphere, let's say, which is N plus one. Just to keep track of the dimensions. Right, so what we find is that these non-conformal brains, you can find a lift where they lift either to the ADS planar black hole in D plus one or to the Ricci flat P brains in N plus P plus three. So these Ricci flat P brains, let me remind you, so you're just taking, let's say, the Schwarzschild black hole and you're adding a number of flat dimensions. And this you can do because this is Einstein's equations in a vacuum, you can always add a direct product which is flat.
Good.
So when you do this mapping between ADS and Ricci flats, there's some analytic continuation going on. And in particular, if you look at this delta exponent that I had and you identify it with these higher dimensional quantities, so D and N, they only live in this higher dimensional ADS and Ricci flat theories. And then if you match both sides, then you're led to this statement, that D becomes minus N. So you might think that this is a bit strange, that I'm doing some weird things with negative number of dimensions. And here I want to stress that this is not what I'm doing. I'm mapping a class, I'm mapping a family of solutions to another family of solutions. That is, those two theories, ADS and Ricci flats, they're never coexisting in the parameter space. There are two complementary parts of the parameter space. So what I'm doing is mapping one part of the parameter space to another part of the parameter space. So in particular, I'm never working with anything that is in a negative number of dimensions. This statement appears if you want to go directly from this side to that side without going to all the trouble of doing the KK reduction. So remember that I was doing this. So these two, I'm mapping them to a theory in P plus two dimensions, which is Einstein-Dilatona. So I get D equals minus N if I want to be lazy and go directly from here to there. But if I do the thing that I should do, that is start from here, go down, and go back up, then the number of dimensions that I have in my space is always positive. There's nothing going wrong.
So this is just a trick. You find equations on one side, you switch D by minus N, and you find equations on the other side.
You can view it.
There's no duality here. There's no claim of equivalence. This is a way of just mapping solutions on one type to another.
You're saying that the field equations are the same under this exchange. The field equations of these two theories are the same.
Well, the field equations, P plus 2, are the same. So when you lift them up, you get a relation between the solutions.
Starting from these two higher dimensional theories.
You're saying that the theories in higher dimensions have the same equation of motion because you've done this reduction.
No, they are not. I'm just giving you a way of going from one side to the other. Then it's a matter of maybe terminology, what you expect from the word duality. And I think that's why we named it correspondence or something, because we thought that duality might be a dangerous term to use. Okay. Any other questions before we continue? Right. So there's already been a number of works that were concerned about building some holographic dictionary for these non-conformal brains, that is, for this lower dimensional P plus 2 theory. And now that you know that you can get this theory by reducing from ADS, it's clear that you can play the game where you try to work out how all the quantities that you have for the holographic dictionary in ADS reduce down to P plus 2 dimensions. It works out quite nicely because, in particular, you can just reduce the Pfefferman-Gram expansion that you had in the higher dimensional theory.
The easiest way of doing that
is not by working in the Einstein frame in the lower dimensional theory. You can choose a frame. This reduction that I showed you doesn't depend on the lower dimensional frame. You can go down to the Einstein frame. You can go to whatever frame you like. One frame which is convenient is this so-called dual frame, where you don't. Right, the dual frame would be the one where you don't put any conformal factor here. So this will modify that conformal factor, but it's still a consistent reduction. So. And it's most convenient because then you can just take the higher dimensional ADS Pfefferman-Gram expansion and reduce it directly. Otherwise, if you have a KK scalar in front of the P plus 2 metric, then you have to mix terms which come from the scalar and terms which come from that part of the metric, so it gets a bit messy. When you write it in this frame, then the G0 and the GD and the G2s that could be there, they're really the same as the higher dimensional ones. Then you find that the lower dimensional scalar operator is just a KK scalar, but this you already knew from what I've told you before. And you can also get the counter terms that allow you to renormalize this P plus 2 dimensional theory. And in particular, so if you were with a planar bound, that dimension is just proportional to the ADS radius, and it picks up some exponential of phi via the reduction. Then you continue, you can identify the lower dimensional holographic stress sensor with the same term as before, that is the dth mode of the Pfefferman-Gram expansion. And you also find that the scalar downstairs acquires a VEV, again, unsurprisingly, because you've broken conformal symmetry. And actually, this VEV parameterizes exactly, when you calculate the trace of the lower dimensional holographic stress tensor, how much you're breaking conformal invariants. And then, okay, you can also derive the equation, the conservation equation for the stress tensor. So that was in P plus 2, so now let's try to go back up in the Ricci flat side of the thing. So in order to do that, you need to make this analytic continuation. And if you lift the non-conformal Pfefferman-Gram expansion, so here I'm really just taking this expression and lifting it and replacing the factors of GDs with the stress tensor, and I've also included a subleading term which goes like the second derivative of the stress tensor or of the scalar VEV. So at the order that I've truncated it, everything goes smoothly because you can see that everything decays asymptotically. R is just the usual radial coordinate that you would use for the Schwarzschild black hole. But there are a number of subtleties. And one of them is that, so here I've truncated the expansion, but if you include all the terms which come at subleading order to the stress tensor, so in ADS they're always subleading, it would come up with either higher powers of the stress tensor or maybe a higher number of derivatives. And they would come with a different power of R, of course. Now, if you look at what that power is on this Ricci flat side, here you see that, for instance, I have n minus 4, then I get n minus 6, n minus 8. That number might become negative. So that thing here might come with a positive power of R and possibly destroy the asymptotics. This is something which is not clear yet. There's some kind of weird thing happening with the expansion. But maybe it's not as dramatic as it sounds, because whatever order I expand things to, this will still be a Ricci flat metric. I'm still getting a metric which solves these equations.
So in the example you showed us, you showed how to map a planar ADS black hole into a standard Ricci flat black brain. So in that case, these terms are all zero, the ones that might have growing powers of R?
Well, in the planar ADS black hole? That yes, they are, because the stress sensor is just a constant, right? I'm not perturbing it.
Okay.
So the temperature is just a constant. So there are no subleading terms with the number of derivatives. I will just get extra powers of the stress sensor, and those will come with like 1/r to the 2n, r to the 3n, 4n. So those guys will always decay.
So the derivatives of the stress sensor which come with.
Yes, exactly. The prime will come with the derivatives. And so like I was saying, so this metric in any way is still Ricci flat. And in particular, you can, because you started from a spacetime with a planar boundary in ADS, you still had a single counter term that you reduced. You got this exponential of phi counter term. Then you can lift it up back again, and then you get this square root of the Ricci scalar that was found already some time ago, in particular by Don, I think. So I still have a Euclidean action which is finite. I have a solution of Ricci flat equations. It just seems that there are some diverging contributions that kick in at a specific order.
So you're saying the same term, the square root of
yeah.
R works even though the metric's not asymptotically flat.
Yeah.
It could be doing something very weird.
Yeah.
This class of solutions.
For this class of solution, yeah. Right. So now let's try to understand a little bit more what does this T mean. So T on the stress sensor on the ADS side, we know very well what it means, was the holographic stress sensor. And here, what we can do is just linearize that metric around Minkowski. So define this perturbation around Minkowski, H. And then you form this particular combination of the metric. And then you find this particular equation. That is, you find that the linearized gravitational field far away from R equals 0 is sourced by this stress tensor. So this stress tensor becomes an effective source for the faraway gravitational field. Basically, because since you've linearized around Minkowski, you've repackaged all the non-linearities of gravity inside this stress tensor and gives you a matter source. Because again, I'm still in vacuum Einstein. I've not put any explicit stress tensor in my equations. So that's why I'm calling it an effective stress tensor.
Sorry, now you're perturbing about just flat Minkowski space.
Yeah, I'm perturbing basically just like killing those terms. H will be those terms here.
But if you took ADS and you performed your transformation, you would just get Minkowski space. Is that right?
I would get a Ricci flat P brain, which is slightly different asymptotically than Minkowski. Minkowski would be without this piece. With this piece just being minus dt squared.
Sorry, ADS with no black hole, no planar black hole.
Yes.
Just pure ADS.
So no planar black hole means that I don't have these terms, I don't have those terms.
Okay.
Then I would get, this term would definitely get, I would get the transverse sphere, and that factor here would be a P brain. So minus dt squared plus a number of flat directions. So this is not Minkowski. It's the difference. These two space times.
Okay. It's closed at line. It's closed at line.
No, so these are the P brains.
I'm sorry, they're both flat.
They're both flat, but one is Minkowski, the other one is not. It's not the same fall offs.
They look like just different coordinates. Isn't the first term dr squared plus r squared d omega? So that's just flat space and spherical coordinates.
Yeah, sure, but I mean when you. Okay, when you.
It's a matter of compact identification.
Yes.
It's a
periodically
identified.
Yes.
So it's what's compactified. Is that right? Different dimensions are compactified.
Yes, this is the difference between these two. So maybe I should call this. I should call this y. Maybe.
Yeah.
This may be clearer. You're not imposing the same asymptotic conditions. It's still Ricci flat, but
it's not
asymptotic.
It actually looks like it's Riemann flat. It's just flat.
In that specific case, it's even Riemann flat.
Yeah. So
but if you put some black hole factors, then it would become just Ricci flat. It wouldn't be Riemann flat.
Sure. Sure, but I was just trying to understand. So you're perturbing. You're thinking about this just in the asymptotic. You want to think of this as a neighborhood of the infinity.
Right. I want to see how things look from the point of view of a faraway observer.
You're saying the perturbation in this space acts as if it was sourced by something sitting at the origin.
Exactly. And this something is not any explicit stress tensor in my field equations because I've not put any there. And to me, the correct way of interpreting this source at r equals 0 is just saying that you've linearized. So all these non-linearities, you had to put them somewhere. And this is where you've put them, in this stress tensor.
But this is a very formal expansion because this AJB generically destroys this endotic set, the AJB. So it's a very formal.
Yes.
Perturbation theory in general is not valid around Minkowski space.
Yeah, fair enough. It's just that, let's say that I'm saying this because at some point then I will talk about black folds, mm-hmm. where you do exactly the same kind of expansion. And in the case of black folds, that stress tensor will become the effective stress tensor for the black fold. This is what I have in mind. Good. So as I told you, so there seems to be some problem when you include an arbitrary number. So if you take a non-constant stress tensor and you include an arbitrary number of derivatives. So let's try to still say something about a stress tensor which is not constant, which is away from equilibrium, but in a way where I can still truncate the number of derivatives. And the most obvious way to do that is just to work in some hydrodynamic limit, which gives me a graded expansion, and then I can work to second order in derivatives and not worry too much about these terms.
But how do you know that those terms will not be much larger if you were to include them? How do you know that you're...
Because it's a gradient expansion. So I'm just...
The gradient expansion is only valid if you know that the higher order terms are indeed smaller than the ones where you're truncating.
Okay, so at worst, I will be able to say that this expansion will be valid in some very large range of R. Maybe not all the way up to R equals infinity, but at least in a very large range. That's why I'm saying that maybe there's some... I've not commented on these two words, asymptotic expansion, but maybe that's something to think about. I don't have any definite answer. But... Okay, so we know how to do hydrodynamics in ADS. This is a very generic expectation that if you take any field theory, you take it at high enough density, then it should equilibrate at least locally. If it equilibrates locally, then you should be able to describe it using Navier-Stokes equations. And in ADS, it was shown that you could do exactly that by considering this type of construction where you take tubes of planar ADS black holes and you superpose them, and the only difference between these tubes is that they have a slightly different fluid velocity and temperature. And if you do that, so if you do this construction, then you find a solution which is regular on the horizon and which describes a black hole with a slowly varying temperature and fluid velocity. So it will not be static any longer, but
you can still do this construction perturbatively.
And so you can do this order by order. It starts sort of the equilibrium order is just the planar ADS black hole. And then you add the next order by varying slowly the temperature, etc., which gives you viscous corrections. This is the story in ADS. It's been very well studied. The original construction was due to these people and was done in Eddington, Finkelstein coordinates. You can derive the stress tensor in this way, in these coordinates, by using a Brownian construction. But okay, you can also go to Pfeffermann-Gram coordinates. And I don't think this was done before, because there was no real reason to do it. But we had the reason to do it because we wanted to be able to extract this T on both sides. So we did that. That was fun. It's not published yet. It should come out in the long version of our paper. So if you're interested into these technical details, they will all be in some appendix at some point. And what you do get, whatever method you use, is this stress tensor here, which is conserved. And in particular, the conformal symmetry fixes all the allowed tensorial structures that can appear. The various coefficients here for the shear viscosity, which comes in front of the shear tensor, or those guys that come at second order in derivatives. In order to know these, you have to calculate with a given geometry. So this is specifically, for instance, with the ADS black brain. But the fact that you get these contributions, I'm not entering into details there because it would be a lot of notation, but all these derivatives of the stress tensor, etc., those are fixed by symmetry. You have to have these and none others. So this is the statement that conformal symmetry organizes the allowed conformal structure in the holographic stress tensor. And then if you perturb around these configurations by small variations of the temperature and the fluid velocity, then you can find that the sound modes are stable. So in particular, there's no instability in the scalar sector. Now let's look at what happens on the Ricci flat side. On the Ricci flat side, what you can do is describe the dynamics of black brains in a long wavelength approximation by some effective work volume theory. This is this black hole approach by Amparan and collaborators. This is something that you can do when you have spacetimes with two length scales, one which describes the global curvature of your spacetime and another one which will typically be the thickness of the brain. And if those scales are very different, then you can build an expansion in the faraway region, in the region very far away from the brain, in the region very close to the horizon, because then you will mainly see a Schwarzschild black hole typically. And then you can make it so that these two regions overlap. And then you can match your quantities in that overlap region. This could match asymptotic expansion. Then you can build a proper solution of, for instance, vacuum Einstein's equations. Then the dynamics of these black brains, once you've done this separation of scales, it can be described by two sets of equations. One set of equation will be related to the extrinsic curvature of the brain, so we'll describe how you can bend the brain in the surrounding spacetime. And another one are just hydrodynamic equations, the Navier-Stokes equations, and they describe how you can fluctuate the brain itself, so fluctuate the fluid velocity and the temperature of the effective stress tensor describing that particular brain. Now, as a check, what we did was so check that if we started from the fluid gravity metric in ADS at first order in derivatives, in ADS they're known to second order in derivatives, but these hydrodynamic black holes, they were only known to first order in derivatives. So as a check that what we were doing was correct, we started from the first order in derivative fluid gravity metric, mapped it to the Ricci flat side, and recovered the first order viscous black holes. Then the next step was to include the second derivatives in the ADS flat, in the ADS side, and then you can derive the second derivative stress tensor on the black hole side. So you get something which is a bit more complicated, there's a bit more structure, basically because conformal symmetry is broken. But the nice thing is that you should remember where this came from. So what I was saying is that this part of the stress tensor was known before, but that part wasn't. And this part, you might have thought that it would be very complicated, but given the way that we obtained it, using information from ADS, it tells you that there is still some remnant, some memory of conformal symmetry, which tells you which conformal structures you can get here. And all these coefficients, they're fixed by the coefficients that were on the ADS side. So even though this is flat space, there's still some memory of conformal symmetry. I've put the word hidden in quotes because it's been used in another different meaning in the literature before, but that's how I think about it. And again, like if you reduce it to first order, it coincides with previous results. Now, there is one problem, which is that if you look at this term, so it's the same as this particular integral here. This particular integral in ADS is always well defined for whatever value of d positive. But when you do the analytic continuation, then this is the same thing that you get with this n describing the dimension of the transverse sphere. This becomes divergent for n equals 1 and n equals 2. Now, in my notation, n equals 1 and n equals 2 means that I have a 2-sphere or a 3-sphere. And I would like to know what happens with the 2-sphere, because that's Schwarzschild black hole.
So we had to think
a little bit about what was going on, but eventually what we realized
is that if you look at this
expansion, this is the Pfeffermann-Gram expansion in ADS. And I've, again, selected a planar boundary metric, just Minkowski. And then you've got all these terms that come at sublinear order to the stress tensor. The stress tensor comes at order d over 2. Now, what happens if you set n equal 1? I'm only going to describe n equal 1. N equal 2 is morally the same thing. But if you set n equal 1, that means setting d equals minus 1 in this expansion, and then you find that some of the terms which are subleading mix with terms that were leading. So you have to take that into account. So typically, so d plus 1 becomes 0, so it's that term here. So it now back reacts on the boundary metric, so you have to account for that with the proper change of coordinates. And that term here comes and renormalizes the stress tensor as well. So once you take that into account, you do the proper change of coordinates, you put the appropriate boundary conditions, that is, you fix the integration constants asymptotically the right way, then you find something which is completely finite. A bit complicated, but completely finite. This is the equation of motion for the stress tensor for n equal 1. And as you can see, there's a bunch of extra terms. I'm not going into any details. It's just to show you that this would have been really hard to guess, just working from the flat side, or even to work out. And in order to do that, we had some help from this Cadabra software that proved really useful.
So if you're going to talk about that.
I'm going to talk about that a little bit.
Can you say it would leave, I mean, this was non-trivial, but you say it would be harder to calculate just directly using the asymptotically flat black hole?
I'm not sure how you, I mean, we knew how what kind of structure we were supposed to look for, so then it was easier. Here I'm showing n equal 1 because it's the most dramatic one. N equal 2 is a bit nicer, there's only 3 or 4 extra pieces. I think got out of hand with an equal one, but right. In fact, you do expect that those pieces should be there, because if you do some dimensional analysis, you work out what is the dimension of the stress tensor, and this will depend on n, and then you realize that for n equal 1, actually all these terms come with exactly the same dimension as the leading order term. So it's not that surprising that they should appear. It's a little bit like the conformal anomalies in ADS. You know that the Ricci scalar has the same dimension as the conservation equation from the stress tensor. So if you have a non-flat boundary metric, it's not surprising that it should be there on the right-hand side. These are a bit the same, except that, okay, they involve the stress tensor itself. From that, you can, after some work, extract some finite stress tensor, which again displays the same kind of tensorial structures. So here the memory of conformal symmetry is a bit lost because we had to work it out from the equations of motion itself. But it's still the same structures that we had in the cases n different from 1 and different from 2. Okay, now I'll go to the last topic of the talk, which is that some very well-known facts about these metrics, these Ricci flat p-brains, is that they are unstable under this Gregor-Laflamme instability. So the Gregor-Laflamme instability is, so you just take a black string. A black string is a Schwarzschild black hole. You add a flat direction. This you can do because it's Ricci flat. So you extend it along some extra flat direction. And then you perturb this black string. And then you find that if the perturbation has a sufficiently long wavelength, then intuitively, let me put the result. But intuitively, it breaks down into it's thermodynamically more favorable for the black string to break down into an array of Schwarzschild black holes that are distributed along this axis, simply because the entropy, so you want to maximize the entropy, so the entropy of the array of Schwarzschild black holes with the same mass is larger than the entropy of the black string with the same mass.
You don't have to use an entropy argument anymore because people have actually numerically evolved this instability, right? Seen it pinch off.
Do they actually see it? They see the pinch being arbitrarily small, right?
You can extrapolate the rate at which it's pinching.
Yeah.
And it's just like the normal fluid of water.
It goes through the cycles, right, of getting very thin black string, little spherical bubbles.
Yeah.
And they go through about four cycles of that, and they time it, and it's getting faster and faster.
So they go up to six generations.
There's six now?
I think they managed to go up to six generations.
You write adaptive code, you can probably do finish.
Well, this was Brown's notorious. I mean, you need adaptive mesh to get to like the second.
Already from the floor.
It's already very small scale structure.
Just got more computer bank. That was the only reason.
Yeah, so I don't need to use the entropy argument, but I think it's nice to give an intuitive argument why you would expect that.
Yeah.
Even though some people have gone and done the hard work and actually showed that it was what was happening. But so even before all that hard work, you could already derive the spectrum of this instability just by doing some linear analysis around the Ricci flat p-brains. And what you find is what I've told you, that is, so this is the frequency of the instability, this is the momentum. Then you find that there is a threshold mode, so it is a large wavelength instability. For small enough wavelength, the black string is stable. And then, okay, you find this nice bell-shaped dispersion relation, which goes all the way down to some zero mode. Because it goes all the way down to a zero mode, this is the region where you should be able to capture using hydrodynamics, because it's long wavelengths and low energies. So if you use this black folds metric and you do this hydrodynamic expansion that I've told you about, then you can work out exactly what is the spectrum of this Kerguelen-Laflamme instability just by perturbing your stress tensor with sound modes. And so what we were able to get is the next order in the dispersion relation, because if you have the first viscous corrections, then you get the k-squared order in the dispersion relation. If you have the second order viscous corrections, then you get the k-cube. And this is the kind of result that you can find. So the dots are numerical data from Paul Figueras, who's a postdoc in Cambridge. And the black curve is the quadratic order, and the pink curve is the cubic order. So notice that the correct bell shape was already captured at quadratic order. And the cubic order allows to make an improvement, but small improvement.
But this is for n equals
7.
So that's nine-dimensional spheres?
Yes. I'm not sure that the exact could have given you n equals 6. It would have looked pretty. The agreement.
It's better.
Give me a minute. I'm getting there.
Yeah.
I'm getting there. So as you increase n, it gets much better. And I think I should. Did I? Yeah, right. So this is a zoom. So for n equal 100, this is a zoom near to the threshold mode. This is the quadratic order, so there was a small difference. And this is with the cubic order, so now there's basically no difference at all. I mean, you could zoom in a bit more, but for all purposes, I think this is enough. And this is not so surprising once you look at the form of the dispersion relation, right? Because if you look at what happens at large n, you can see that if you rescale k by the square root of n and omega by the right power of n as well, then you will find something which goes exactly as you increase n, which gets more and more precise. So in particular, if you go into these very large n limits and you derive the expression for the threshold mode using this thing, this is what we got. And again, it agrees. So this term here, which is a new term, this comes from that term, it agrees with some previous work by Barak Kohl that they got from a completely different direction by assuming that the number of dimensions was large from the beginning, without taking any hydro approximation. So here, basically, the upshot of the Largen limit is that it enhances your hydrodynamic limits, because the effective momentum becomes k over k over square root of n, which, if n is arbitrarily large, becomes arbitrarily small for a larger range. So, and I think also Roberto Amparani is now working on this Largen limit, so he has more to say about that, but the paper hasn't been published yet.
So he has to simplify the Largen limit.
I think he's basically, so what he's basically saying is that if you take the large, so the very large dimension limit, gravity just becomes some like dust motes that are not interacting with each other. Like you've got a dust of black holes who do not see each other. So it does some very, very funny things. Okay. And now let me go back to the case n equal 1, which, as you remember, was a bit problematic. And it's even more problematic here because it comes with the wrong sign in the dispersion relation. And, okay, I've checked it, John checked it, Marco checked it. Once three people have checked it, and they also got the same answer, it probably means that you have to live with it, and that's how things are. And how things are is that instead of coming down like it does in the quadratic case, because there's a minus sign, it just goes up when k is large. Maybe it's not so dramatic, because in this case, I mean, k over square root of n is really not that small as soon as k becomes big. So maybe in that case, you really had no right to expect that you should capture a threshold mode, even if that threshold mode would have been off by quite a factor.
I'm curious, didn't you have all the problems with n equal 1 and n equal 2 that required a reshuffling, and therefore you would expect that some things work worse just because of that?
Yeah. At the technical level, yeah, you would expect that once things stop working nicely. I don't know. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
For sufficiently small k.
Yeah, for sufficient.
Still gives you a better you can.
Well, for sufficiently small k, if you focus here, there was already nearly no distinction that you could make between the.
There must be a range that gets slightly better, or not, right? There is a range there that has.
Yeah, there should. There should. I don't remember exactly. So.
Yeah, that's fine.
But I guess if you zoom in really, really hard here.
Exactly. I'm not sure the marks are good enough to let you zoom in.
But then
they are. Of course, here they are. Up to 10 to the minus 10, if you want, or 10 to the minus 12.
Fine. Yes?
Do you know graphene was the sign for the k in the first term, or is the sign of the k?
Well, so that's why I'm saying that it might be an asymptotic expansion. That is, it might be that you have, you know, the signs alternating with each. So maybe you recover the correct shape to the next order. But to get the next order, you need to get the next order in derivatives in the stress sensor. And I mean, you're welcome to do that.
There's been some recent work in that direction by Michael Heller from Amsterdam.
Right, and he's also talking about asymptotic expansion, right?
He claims that the correction is grow factorial.
But that's what you expect from asymptotic expansion.
I haven't read that paper, but I've vaguely heard about that, and yeah. But this is an ADS. Well, this is an UTFAT, but okay. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let me give you my summary. I've shown you how you could map a certain class of asymptotically locally ADS spacetimes to a certain class of Ricci flat spacetimes. I've shown you that hydrodynamics on one side is completely equivalent to hydrodynamics on the other side, which is, well, reassuring to some extent. I've also shown you that even on the flat side, it seems that conformal symmetry still plays a role in telling you which tensor structures you can have in your stress tensor. Using this. Another upshot of this technique that I've showed you is that you can use that as a solution generating technique. If you know something on one side, you can know the equivalent metric on the other side. So in particular, it was interesting for these hydrodynamic metrics because since we already knew the second order in derivative solution on the ADS side, it gave you the second order in derivative solution on the Ricci flat side for free, which would have been a bit of work to work out from scratch. I've showing you some results that you can get from the Gregor-Leflin instability from that. And in particular, it gives very, very good agreements provided and it's not equal one or two. Some outlook. You've seen that in what I was doing, I was never touching the sphere on the Ricci flat side. So if you want to make progress towards understanding Ricci flat space holography, clearly this is something that you have to do. You need to deform the sphere. One place to start might be to be looking at these extrinsic black fold deformations that were worked out at first order by these people some time ago. I've also not told you about curved boundary metrics. That's what you would need to do in order to talk about the Schwarzschild black hole in particular. One thing that I'm just mentioning is there's been a lot of work on Rinder fluids over the past couple of years. If you take this Ricci flat black hole matrix and you set n equals minus 1, so n equals minus 1 just tells that the transverse sphere is vanishing. Then you recover exactly all the results that were worked out for the Rinder fluids using the black hole stress tensor that we had. As you might expect, since the metric reduces to the Rinder metric. Now, I've already mentioned that there was quite a bit of literature on this hidden conformality, conformal symmetry for asymptotically flat black holes. And in particular, it involves shuffling around conformal factors, putting flat Schwarzschild black holes in a box. Well, I've just shown you a way that you can go from ADS to a Ritz, which acts like a box, to Ricci flat spacetime. So maybe there's something to it that could be understood along the lines that I've shown you. And I'll stop here and thank you for your attention.
So in addition to the sort of black string that you talked about, it's known that there are these non-uniform black strings where the horizon basically oscillates. My static Ricci flat metrics, which have been constructed numerically. So using your procedure, does this imply some non-uniform black grains in ADS?
Okay, so the statements. Let me go back here. Let me go back to this slide. So if the fluctuation of the black string is confined in this part of the metric on the Ricci flat side, which I think it is from what you told me, then you can carry it through to the other side. The only problem is that in order for that to work, like I told you, you need to map families of solutions to families of solutions. And I'm assuming that the numerics, you know them for, let's say, D equals 4, D equals 5, D equals 6. You will need to know the solution for arbitrary D. You will need to make some statements at arbitrary D, and then you could do the analytic continuation. So you could probably make some statements using the perturbative non-uniform black string, but not the full numerical solution, because the full numerical solution only exists for a specific D, for a specific dimension.
But does this imply just the mere existence of non-uniform grains in ADS?
Right. I just want to know about the existence of a new class of solutions which may not have found.
Okay, so let me put it this way. Any solution that you have on the Ricci flat side with respect to those symmetries gives rise to another family of solution in ADS that respect those symmetries.
Sounds interesting.
Then certainly, I mean, these solutions maintain the spherical symmetry, which is the only thing you need.
So if they do that, then there is a corresponding class of solutions on the other side.
But you have to work out in the derivative expansion of these labels.
But that would be fine, right? If you're not deforming the transverse sphere.
You might have to think, because this might destroy the asymptotics. Right? I mean, the solutions you're talking about are asymptotically flat.
Yes.
But when you map into the asymptotics of the ADS, it better be that the terms with the Wiggles do not destroy the asymptotics of ADS.
Yeah, you'd have to work it out, but.
And I think that's probably what happens. These small Wiggles will destroy the asymptotics.
No, but they have to be asymptotically ADS. They have to, just because they obey the right field equations.
That's not enough to map them.
Well, no, the field equations don't determine the boundary conditions.
it doesn't have to be asymptotically ABS. It can be a space with a negative cosmological constant.
But it's not, no, wait, the Pfefferon-Gram expansion is a statement about Einstein's equation with a negative cosmological constant. It tells you that any solution to those equations can be put in the Pfefferon-Gram
right,
form.
It will give you a boundary metric that is not flat. So the way you solve, these solutions will give you a boundary metric that is not flat.
Okay, yeah, but that's fine.
So they're forced.
No, it's not.
They're not spontaneously. They don't break spontaneously.
I'm sorry, you sourced?
When you change the metric, you've sourced some deformation of your system. So you
force it. They're not spontaneous. They will appear.
I'm just not understanding the vocabulary.
So the wiggles that show up in these non-uniform strings, when you map it back to the ADS, will show up in the boundary metric.
That could very well be.
So then it's not surprising.
You
look for a solution with certain wiggles at infinity, and then, of course, you end up with horizons with the same wiggles.
But, I mean, it's pretty easy to check.
Other questions?
Okay, let's thank Liz again.